Okay, last week, we did the introduction to the book of Ruth, where we took some time looking at the social and historical settings from which this book is drawn from. Okay, so we can better understand the significance of some of the things that are in here. Now, Ruth is all of the Bible is very, very special, and there's a lot of information in there and a lot of description of the Lord Himself that we might get to know Him better. Ruth is special in a special way. In there is so many word pictures, so many things. You know, Jesus taught in parables, and there are so many parable-like things in Ruth that we can get indications from and understanding about our Lord. And this week, we're actually going to go to the book of Ruth, which hopefully you're excited about. Of course, after last week, maybe you've had enough of it. I don't know. So, Ruth 1. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and his name of his wife was Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon, Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to the country of Moab and remained there. Now last week we went into great detail talking about the situations and probably the causes of the famine that were there. There was probably great civil unrest that was going on there. So it was not just famine, but also a very difficult and very trying, very dangerous place at the time. So Elimelech went and took his family to Moab for economic reasons, also safety reasons, as he went. Now, one thing that we should point out here, this is very interesting. Elimelech means God is my king, which is kind of an interesting thing. It tells us a little bit about Elimelech. Naomi means, his wife, means pleasant. She was a very pleasant person. Mahlon, his oldest son, his name means sickly. And Chilion means weak or failing. Now, a lot of you out there are parents, and you have your children, and when you were expecting and stuff, you work together and try to figure out the names and stuff. So how many people chose a name meaning sickly for their children? Probably not many of you. One thing to remember here is that names back at that time in ancient Israel were more important than they are now. They weren't just a moniker. A name was an identity. A name was something. We see a situation where God changes the name of Abram to Abraham and Sarai to Sarah. He changes the name of Jacob to Israel. Which was a change. One thing I'll relate here is that Jacob, means rascal. And as we read a lot of the accounts of Jacob in his younger years, he fit that description. And God then changed his name to Israel at a time shortly thereafter where he became a different kind of person. To give an example, we are today give names that sound good. I'm reminded of a case that I'm familiar with. There was a young lady who was going to high school, and she was in the classroom, and the teacher was up in front taking roll, going through the thing on the first day of that class, and the teacher reading down read her name, which was L-A-S-H-A. So he called out, Lasha. And she stood up, she was all upset. Why do you people always get it wrong? I can't understand it. The name is Ladasha. The dash is not silent. I'm sorry, that's a little funny to me. But I think with biblical names, in some cases, they're used to describe the person. They may not be the actual name that was given to the person, but it is an identity. One of the things that will go on, we'll read in here, is in Exodus, is that he says, who's talking about the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. Now, God's name is not Jealous, okay, but his identity of who he is jealous. He is a jealous God. He's not jealous, in case you get this wrong like Oprah did, he is not jealous of you, he is jealous for you. Okay? Very important distinction. One thing to point out here too, it mentions that these people were Ephrathites. You notice a lot of words in the Bible are tough to pronounce, you know, that's rather interesting. In case that gets confusing to you, the Ephrathites were a clan of the tribe of Judah. Okay, we can, and I've got a thing there in the notes in 1 Chronicles to point that out. Chapter 4, verses 1 and 4. The sons of Judah were Perez, Hezron, Carmi, Hur, and Shobal. These were the sons of Hur, the firstborn, Ephrathah, the father of Bethlehem. So you remember when Joshua came into the land, they divided the land up by tribes of Israel, and one section went to that tribe. And that those sections then were sectioned off by clans. Okay, this clan goes here and there and there. And as they grew, okay, somewhat like the different tribes had states, okay, and the clans were counties within that area. So that describes that. That goes on, so we got that. Also, it was interesting that it was the family of Hur, okay, and which were so famous that they made a movie, you know, about Judah Ben-Hur. In Ruth chapter 1, verses 3 to 5, then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. Now they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, the name of the other Ruth, and they dwelt there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died, so the women survived her two sons and her husband. Now it's interesting here, I mean they say that they were there 10 years, but they don't say from when, at the point of the death, or whether that was in total that went on. One thing, this was very significant in this part, in that women in those days, okay, were extremely dependent financially on their husbands or their sons for their financial well-being and their provision. There was no welfare, you know, by the state. There was no WIC. There was no, you know, all the safety nets and such that are there today were not in existence. So this was a very severe situation for Naomi that went on. Her situation was extremely bleak without her husband and sons. And this was especially so since she was a foreigner in Moab. Okay, so none of her extended family were there at that time. Another point here is that the Israelites were not to marry foreign people. This is noted in several places, and I'm going to give you several examples there. This is a little bit of overkill, but I think it leads to a point. In Exodus 34, 14 to 16, for you shall worship no other god, for the Lord whose name is Jealous is a jealous God, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they play the harlot with their gods and make sacrifice to their gods, and one of them invites you and you eat his sacrifice, and you take his daughters for your sons, and his daughters play the harlot with their gods and make your sons play the harlot with their gods. in Deuteronomy 7:1, when the Lord your God brings you into the land which you go to possess, and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you. And when the Lord your God delivers them over to you, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them, nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughters to their son, or take their daughter for your son. And in Joshua 23:11-14, therefore take careful heed to yourself that you love the Lord your God, or else if indeed you do go back and cling to the remnant of these nations, these that remain among you, and make marriages with them, and go into them, and they to you, know for certain that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations before you, but they shall be snares and traps to you, and scourges on your sides, and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from this good land which your God has given you. Now, and I could have pulled out a dozen more examples of this, where the Lord leads His people not to marry other people. I mean, I think it's important then that it goes beyond this. I mean, these things are effective. I mean, we see the results of this in the case in Judges, where the people were wooed away from the Lord and began worshiping Baal or, you know, all the other gods from the nations around there, and they got into sexual immorality and left the Lord and forgot Him. Okay, so it went on. And the tragic circumstances which resulted, you know, they went from affluence and great prosperity, you know, into a situation where they were afflicted on all sides. They had the opposite of prosperity. You know, we have a situation where they have famine. You know, those warnings were very true for Israel, but I think are true for us to hear today. The thing is that we're told, you know, in the New Testament, not to be yoked together with unbelievers. And I've seen myself, okay, an awful lot of examples where this is the case. Okay, I've seen, there was one example of a lady that I know of, and she went to a church that was, well, didn't strongly teach the Bible, okay, and she went there, and so she went to the church fairly regularly, and she assumed that she was a Christian. And she wanted a good marriage and good relationship, and she had views of a great family and stuff, which I suppose we all do, you know, kind of a thing. So her thing was to make sure she wanted to marry a Christian man, and so she got on the Christian dating site, you know, and found a man, and ended up, they had a relationship and got married. That didn't last very long. For an awful lot of reasons, most of which is that neither one of them were really Christians, and so they were definitely lured into the world. She ended up using the Christian dating site multiple times. She went through three marriages and suffered things of abuse and all the bad that goes along with that. And that's I think God lays out, you know, for us, when He says that we are not to be yoked with unbelievers, He assumes that we're believers ourselves, okay? And in a situation of, you both have a central thing to go to, an anchor, a central point, a hub of the wheel that you can go to that draws you together. The thing is, if you're both searching, if you're both journeying to the same place, doesn't matter how far apart you are, that as you go towards that place, you get closer and closer and closer together. People where they're unequally yoked in that, and Kevin has warned the congregation multiple times about that sort of thing, is that you are on a path that is often divergent. Maybe it crosses each other, but you're aim, your target, is somewhere that is drawing you, can draw you much further apart. You know, the thing is that these kind of warnings from God, you know, we have the Ten Commandments, we have all the laws and encouragements that go along with that. Those things are not to shackle us and to limit us. Those things are to protect us. You know, we can, by following those, we can stay out of a lot of heartache, you know, that goes on. You know, I know of, going back to the other subject, a situation where a woman had a relationship with a guy, and he vehemently claimed that he was a Christian because he went to church fairly regularly. Well, after years of marriage and seeing no fruit of that, they ended up splitting up. You know, I know a guy that I used to work with at Boeing, and he became a Christian, and his wife was not a Christian. Not only was not a Christian, but was really anti-Christian. And as that went on, I mean, there was all kinds of heartaches associated with that. I mean, he was constantly put in situations of trials for that. So the thing is, those guidances from God, okay, come to us for our own good, and we are much happier for following them, okay, when we do. Anyways, back to our story. Ruth 1:6-9. Then she arose, that is Naomi, arose with her daughter-in-law, that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. Therefore, she went out from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you, as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant you may find peace, each in the house of her husband." Now, it's interesting to note here that the three of them started the journey together, leaving the country of Moab and going back to Judah. We don't know where in Judah they were traveling from. Nothing tells us, you know, a location, basically in Moab where they were living. But it is likely that they had to travel more than 80 miles to get to Bethlehem. You remember we went over last week the position of Moab is east of the southern portion of the Dead Sea. So they had to go down and around the Dead Sea and all the way up, probably going through the area of Arad and on up to circle inside the Judean foothills and stuff, which would make traveling much easier. So they had a very long way to go that would have taken them many days in order to do that. Along with this, obviously, they had to take with themselves provisions, okay, water and food sources and stuff like that, which would have slowed down how much progress they could make. Along the way, they've got a long time, a lot of time to go. Naomi started getting second thoughts, okay, because they'd made the decision to go and they're going. Naomi had second thoughts, and she started asking herself, would this be good for her daughters-in-law? She didn't really know how she was going to fare by herself, okay, going, didn't know what kind of reception. She's been gone at least 10 years from the area. She doesn't know what she's going back to, sort of a situation. She starts dealing, I might have trouble just getting provisions there for myself, let alone for two extra people that are coming on. And what good would it do to them? I mean, they will be in a situation where they will be in a foreign land without provision. It could be very dicey for them. So she started thinking, well, from a worldly standpoint, you know, it makes more sense. I mean, they probably have better odds, you know, in their own country where their families are at, where they're familiar with their surroundings and going. In Ruth 1:9-13, so she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, surely we will return to your people. Now, this shows that she had a very close relationship with her two daughters-in-law. This pleasant woman was very special to the young ladies. I mean, to think that they would even initially make, that commitment to travel to Israel rather than return to what they were familiar with, which is probably very close at hand, not 80 miles away. This was probably, they were probably living in the town that, where these girls came from. Obviously, they had an extremely high opinion of Naomi and felt very good with her in order to want to stay with her. In spite of all those things, they wanted to go. There's an old saying, I think, that applies here, that you see that even in this, in the initial decision, that they were courageous. Okay, the old saying is that the devil you know is more favorable than the devil you don't know. Okay, meaning the unknown is always a very scary thing. Okay, it's always there, and you're always thinking about all the things that could be wrong and could go wrong with the unknown. You don't know what this is, you don't know what that is. You don't know, with them, they don't know how they're going to be restored or how they're going to be received by the people. In this foreign place they're going to, a land that really doesn't think much of the Moabites to begin with. The fear of the unknown is a very, very powerful thing. There's a story that was related to me by Frosty Westering. There was a king, and he was a very harsh king, very gruff, and known as for cruelty. And he held all the cases for major criminal acts, and he heard them himself. Now, there was a prince from another land that came to learn his ways and how he did things, and he was there. So they went into the room where he heard the cases, and he noticed along one wall there were three doors. There was a green door, a red door, and a black door. And the young prince asked the king, he says, well, what is this? And he says, well, when the people come in here and I hear the cases, and if they're found guilty of a major crime, then they are sentenced, and they must pick one of these doors. And he says, the green door here is that you will be sentenced to slavery, to hard labor, under harsh conditions for the rest of your life. The red door was you could choose that you would go in there and immediately be executed. Okay. And then there was the black door that you could choose. And the prince thought about that for a little bit, and he said to the king, he said, how many people choose which door? And he said, well, almost nobody chooses the black door in that. And the prince thought, well, what is behind the black door? And he said, freedom. The thing is, people were so scared of the unknown that they wouldn't choose that one. Anyways, so these ladies were dealing with that, with the unknown, and they overcame that. In verse 11, but Naomi said, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Turn back, my daughter, go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have a husband tonight and should also bear sons, would you wait for them till they are grown? Would you restrain yourselves from having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against us. It's interesting here that Naomi also believes that God has turned against her. Okay, obviously, her death of her husband, the death of her two sons, her being basically in this no future, wherever she lived. And she was afraid that by staying with her, the two daughters-in-law may be afflicted under that punishment. And perhaps she thought that the punishment from God was the result of her sons marrying foreigners. And this was coming out. As we will see, God had a plan to bring great blessing out of tragic situation. In Ruth 1, 14 to 15, then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, "Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." Naomi states here that Orpah is going back to her gods as well as her people. This indicates at some point she had originally left her gods for the God of Israel, which tells you something about the household that they were in. This guy who his God was his king. Okay, maybe they had family Bible studies, you know, although the printing press wasn't going to be invented for another 2,500 years from this point. But the thing is, they had learned enough to be worshiping the God of Israel, and that was in there. And this particular situation, so Orpah decides, okay, what Naomi's saying makes sense to me. I mean, there's some real sense here. She's got better odds. She doesn't have to travel as far. She can go back to a place that she's familiar with. She can have a better chance of getting a husband because it's going to be very challenging to go to a place where Moabites are looked down upon and to then find a good husband. And so her odds of success, okay, are superior by following Naomi's advice. And so she finally decides to do that. She finally decides, okay, I'm going to stay here in Moab. And in Moab, you worship the Moabites' gods, Baal and Chemosh, and she's probably going to do that. It also reminds us of, remember that Jesus taught largely in parables and stuff, and this is full of things that relate to that, I think. We remember the parable of the farmer with the sower, you know, that he went on some. I think this illustrates a little bit of that, in that some of the seed was on rocky soil, and it sprouted up, okay, as Orpah was worshiping the God of Israel, okay, in the household, we're assuming. And now things are getting harsh and getting challenging, and trials are there, and she is going to wither under the heat of those trials, and she's going to continue to stay with her people in Moab and go back to the gods of the world that are in there. Okay, in Ruth 1, 16 to 22, "But Ruth said, 'Entreat me not to leave you, or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. The Lord do to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me.'" And I think this further illustrates the point that they had become believers to some extent in the Jewish God. You'll notice in verse 17 that she says Lord there. The word is actually Jehovah. Okay, she's calling out God by name, kind of thing. So it isn't just an offhanded reference, but this is the actual recognition of that God. And Ruth is appealing to the Jewish God's name. We assume that by this, we continue to build on that, that they were believers accordingly. Going on in verse 18, "When she," that is Naomi, "saw that she," Ruth, "was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her." And we don't know here, because it just says that she stopped speaking to her, We don't know if that meant she stopped speaking to her about leaving or just stopped speaking to her altogether. I don't know exactly how that goes. You can use your own insights in there to determine what the case was. Now the two of them went until they came to Bethlehem. And it happened when they had come to Bethlehem that all the city was excited because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" But she said to them, "Do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has afflicted me?" Naomi is very saddened by her situation. I mean, you can imagine if she left Bethlehem and went to Moab, everything was great. They were looking for a better place. I mean, things were not great in Bethlehem, obviously. They left. They went to Moab. She had her husband and her sons, and she's feeling good, and things are going to be great. And she goes there, and all of that is gone. Now she's returning, not returning like they say, "Oh, there's Naomi, and she did really well, and we're really proud of, you know, all the stuff she did." But she came back basically destitute. Okay, kind of a thing. Life is not working out the way that she had intended. She's faced the trials and the challenges, and very severe ones at that. And as a result, she's really down. And I think all of us can probably associate with this. I mean, we've had situations where we're kind of excited about some possibility. We've got dreams. Things are going to work out a certain way that are going on, and they don't work that way. Okay? For some reason, things fall apart. Things don't go the way we do. And there is a real temptation for all of us to then get bitter. Well, God is just against me and punishing me and such like that, and there's nothing I can do, you know. And that's the same with Naomi. But God sometimes has a larger field of vision. He sees more there. The thing is, Naomi may have come back to Bethlehem destitute, not the way she would have wanted, but the Lord brought her back. She was back with her people. It's interesting, too, that they were excited. Naomi's back. You know, the people are running out. You know, does this night, Naomi? Oh, great. We haven't seen her in 10 years. But there's no mention that they said anything to Ruth or acknowledged her at all. Okay, that's there. So she was a Moabite. Okay, which we know, we went over last week how there was a bad impression of the Moabites, and as a result, kind of a thing. So we can kind of read in there, and we wonder, okay, actually, what kind of reception that she got there. In verse 22, "So Naomi returned, and Ruth, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab. Now they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest." Now, one thing to point out here, that barley is the first grain to ripen, the major crops that they plant in Israel. And it is barley, remember, that is used as an offering at the festival of first fruits. It was the first crop that was offered up to the Lord at the festival of first fruits. A day, the festival of first fruits, a day that would be very important to us, when Jesus rose from the grave as the first fruits from the dead. Okay, so there's some, you'll have to work at it a little bit, but there is some symbology that goes in there. And Ruth, for all intention and purposes, I mean, her life as far as what she dreamed of is over, is dead. But there's another life coming. Normally, I should also point out that normally the barley harvest begins in our month of April. Okay, going forward. Now, obviously, the Jewish calendar, you've got leap months and stuff, so sometimes things at a different time. It would be normally in the month of Nisan, according to the Jewish calendar. There was a relative of Naomi's husband, a man of great wealth, the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. So Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, "Please let me go to the field and glean heads of grain after him in whose sight I may find favor." Now, one thing to keep in mind here is that "him" used here is a generic term. Okay, it does not refer to anyone in particular. I mean, although it tells us that Boaz was indeed of the family, it is not her saying, "Okay, I'm going to go out and with some member of the family." She was just going to go out, okay, and whoever allowed her into glean, that was what she was going to do. And they had to do this. She had to glean in order to get provision for Naomi and herself, Ruth, so that they could live. There was no food stamps at that time. You know, that was the method that God had set up for the people that were in poverty, you know, in order to get sustenance, to get provision. And she, Naomi, said to her, "Go, my daughter." That's a good idea. Then she left and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered him, "The Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" Now this is a good insight too. It tells us a lot about Boaz. I mean, he gives a godly greeting when he comes. And it also tells us that he was a real hands-on guy. I mean, he just didn't send the servant out there to do the stuff, and he stayed in Bethlehem in the city there and doing the important stuff of somebody that was in society high up and stuff like that. Rather, he was out there regularly. We know this because he knew immediately when there was somebody other than his servants that was there. Okay, so it tells us a little bit about him as a person. So the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered and said, "It is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. And she said, 'Please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves.' So she came and has continued from morning until now, though she rested a little in the house." So the thing is, we know that Ruth being there, okay, in Bethlehem was kind of the talk of the town. He refers, "Oh, she's that woman who showed up with Naomi and has been there." The one, and assumed that Boaz would know immediately who that was. This also shows us a little bit insight into Ruth. She got there and worked hard all day long. I mean, she did take a break, you know, kind of a thing. But she was there. She was a hard worker and going about her business. In verse 8, "Then Boaz said to Ruth, 'You will listen, my daughter, will you not? Do not go to glean in another field, nor go from here, but stay close by my young women. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Have I not commanded the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn.'" So, Boaz is making it very clear to Ruth that he's going to take care of her. Okay, he's concerned about her. He's going to make sure that she is taken care of. Now, as we go on later here, he notices that "I've told the young men not to touch you." You know, so we can relate to that, that gleaning, going out and gleaning among, in the fields was some, could be hazardous to women. It was not, you know, despite all the laws and stuff providing that, it was somewhat dangerous. Okay, but he has left strict orders that nothing is supposed to happen. And you make sure that she's taken care of, that she has access. She tells the men she has access to their water, and they are to be, allow her to be right there with all the other people in the gleaners. In verse 10, so she fell on her face, bowed down to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" And Boaz answered and said to her, "It has been fully reported to me all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you have left your father and your mother and the land of your birth, and have come to a people whom you did not know before. The Lord repay your work, and a full reward will be given to you by the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge." Now the thing is, we don't know exactly what the talk was, what the situation was, the outlook of the people upon this Moabitress, this person, outsider that had came into the town of Bethlehem. From reading the other stuff that were in there, I suppose it's like anything, even today, you know, there are some people who are going to assume the worst sort of situation. Oh, that's an outsider, you know, no good person. We don't want anything to do with it. And then there's some other people that, you know, are very welcoming. They're looking for the good stuff. One thing in here in Boaz, he shows he has some real insight. He says, "Okay, I'm impressed. You know, you did something that was very courageous. You came to a new land and a new people, kind of a thing. And you've done an exceptional job of taking care of your mother-in-law and all the things associated with that. You know, I'm really impressed with that." In 13, "Then she said, 'Let me find favor in your sight, my lord, for you have comforted me and have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants.' Now Boaz said to her at mealtime, 'Come here and eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in vinegar.' So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed parched grain to her, and she ate and was satisfied and kept some back. And when she rose up to glean, Boaz commanded his young men, saying, 'Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. Also let grain from the bundles fall purposely for her. Leave it as that she may glean, and do not rebuke her.'" Okay, so as is going on, Boaz is becoming more impressed with her. Okay, doing the thing. And he says, "Okay, we're gonna make sure that things work out good for her, and that she stays here." So he tells his men to go the extra mile, you know, so to speak, to make sure that she is successful doing the gleaning that is there. In verse 17, "So she gleaned in the field until evening and beat out what she had gleaned. And it was about an ephah, which is 26 quarts of barley. Then she took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. So she brought out and gave to her what she kept back after she had been satisfied." This referring to the part that she had for lunch. This, and she worked, you know, basically all day long, into the evening, into the time that the sun was going down. And she gathered up 26 quarts of barley and then stored it. I don't know if she had a bag or, you know, a cloth or kind of thing. But 26 quarts is a lot of grain. I mean, that's a lot of grain. And then she walked, you know, back to wherever in Bethlehem, there where her mother-in-law was staying. So there was a lot there. And then she had the other stuff from the already roasted grain besides that. 19, "And her mother-in-law said to her, 'Where have you gleaned today? And where did you work? Blessed be the one who took notice of you.' So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, 'The man's name whom I worked today is Boaz.' Then Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "Blessed be he of the Lord, who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead." And Naomi said to her, "The man is a relation of ours, one of our close relatives." This is one of those things where coincidence looks like it had a purpose and was put there on purpose. I mean, Ruth went out to go wherever she could to glean, to find things to glean. There's an awful lot of fields in Bethlehem, owned by an awful lot of different people going on. She happened to choose the one that was a close relative. Was this just a coincidence, or was this part of the plan that was laid out before her? I think we can all see, even in our own lives, if you think back and you think back to different circumstances, you go, you know, I could have chosen this or that, you know, this fork in the road or that fork in the road, and I chose this one. And by choosing that one, that opened up a lot of options, you know, that were there that led me. Many of you, it was a situation where you were not looking for the Lord particularly, but somebody was sharing about the Lord, and you happened to choose to listen to them, you know, that set a path onward that brought you here and gathered together where bells go off and stuff like that. So, in verse 21, Ruth the Moabitess said, "He also said to me, 'You shall stay close to my young men until they have finished all my harvest.' And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, 'It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, and that people do not meet you in any other field.' So she stayed close by the young women of Boaz to glean until the end of the barley harvest and wheat harvest, and she dwelt with her mother-in-law." This is significant in before the barley harvest is completely finished, the wheat harvest begins. And the wheat harvest lasts all the way through May and sometimes into June going in there. So she ended up staying, gleaning in the fields of Boaz probably 6-7 weeks this went on. I'm real tempted to go on with the story, but the thing is, there's only 4 chapters in Ruth, and if I only leave 1 chapter, that's going to make it very difficult for the person to finish up on, to stretch 1 chapter out for all that. I hate to leave that one. Oh, it's just getting good. Yeah. Let's pray. Oh, Lord, once again, we give you thanks, Lord, for this opportunity that we have to gather together, to lift you up, to seek you out, Lord, to learn more of you, to fellowship with one another in glorifying you. And, oh, Lord, we give you thanks for the great fellowship that we share, oh, Lord, and all the special people gathered here to bring that are so encouraging to all of us. Oh, Lord, I ask for your special hand of blessing upon this church, Lord, this body of believers. And, Lord, draw each and every heart closer to you and help us to reach out and bring more people into the kingdom of God. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Jesus, I believe he is the Son of God. I believe he died and rose again. I believe he paid for us all. And I believe he is here now. standing in our midst, here with the power to heal now, and the grace to forgive. I believe in you, Lord. I believe you are the Son of God. I believe you died and rose again. I believe you paid for us all. And I believe you are here now, standing in our midst, here with the power to heal now, and the grace to forgive. And I believe you are here now, standing in our midst, here with the power to heal now, and the grace to forgive. And the grace to forgive.
And he is indeed standing in our midst, and he does have that power. Now, most of you, I know, that are here, but if there's anybody here today that does not know the Lord, you know, and you want to know more, you want to get to know him personally and have that personal relationship, feel free to come and talk to me or talk to any of the other people here, especially maybe the people, you know, brought you if you were here that way. But do not put off beginning that relationship. Okay, and I never know exactly what to say here in closing. But anyways, thank you for coming here. You're a great inspiration and encouragement to me, whether I'm at the pulpit or not, just a lot of you seeing you, and your great smiles and so forth. Go in peace, enjoy the week, and look to him in all things.